Well, Jack, I've known you for 52 years, and for at least 30 of those or so, you've taught ethics. And I've never had a chance to sit in one of your classes, and now I consider it a privilege tonight to hear you explain, what do you mean by ethics? What is the discipline called ethics?
I once heard ethics defined as what Lawrence Welk says after he says, a one, a two, a three, a four, a five. Ethics is what comes next. Ethics.
Oh. We are now old enough to listen to his music, aren't we?
Ethics is much more serious, of course, sometimes defined as the science of morality. Again, science as organized thinking about something. Organized thinking about matters that have to do with right and wrong. Terms like right and wrong are the kind of key words in ethics. And they're not synonymous with good and bad, although sometimes we use them interchangeably. You can talk about a bad apple, but you won't say a wrong apple. Right and wrong are terms that are peculiar words that relate to human behavior. And part of our problem in recent years is the changing of the presuppositions so that our language of the past as it relates to the present doesn't say quite the same things. We've lost some of the seriousness of doing ethics, for example, when we lost the term sin. Talking about wrong behavior in the past, this was sinful behavior. But sin is a theological word and is only appropriate when you're dealing with God. You sin against God or against a neighbor, but it is something that has a theological kind of frame of reference. And in a society that has largely lost its theological underpinnings, now we talk about sociopathic behavior, maladaptive coping behavior, whatever, rather than the old-fashioned word sin. Recently, Carl Menninger, who's kind of the dean of American psychiatrists, who's a Presbyterian Sunday school teacher, by the way, wrote a book some years ago entitled Whatever Became of Sin. He described how psychiatry, including his own efforts, had changed the field and had gotten rid of sin. And he suggested in that book that we did so at great loss, that we need to discover the seriousness of ethics as suggested by that old-fashioned term, if we're going to be able to deal with matters of guilt and other things that psychiatrists are concerned about in their work.
Can I ask you a question about your use of the word science in there?
Yes.
The science of ethics. Is it that well organized and defined that it could be called science?
If you use the word science broadly, now this is not talking about natural sciences or what the scientist is usually doing. This is a behavioral science. See? And thinking about ethics is sufficiently organized that one does have to, I think, talk about it in those formalized terms. The science of ethics, the science of morality. By the term I'm using, as I'm using it, I'm talking about organized thinking about something. There's also a nuance difference between ethics and morals that is not ordinarily picked up in everyday usage. Some ethicists still haven't caught this nuance difference, but there is a significant difference between what the Germans call ethic and Sitte, that is, behavior according to ethics, behavior according to custom, Sitte being a term for custom. And most of the time, the term moral refers to such things as our mores, the patterns of behavior that we have inherited from our culture, which we define as right and wrong, or these are defined for us, usually by those who pass them along to us, our parents and others, who tell us what right and wrong is. But these are pretty well-established behavioral patterns. And one is a moral person in terms of whether or not he conforms to the mores or the moral patterns that he's received. Ethics, on the other hand, suggests a somewhat less traveled pattern. That is, when one faces the question, what shall I do? He may have to do ethics. Shall I do it is a moral question. He already knows what to do. And shall I do it or not? Shall I conform or not? Is the moral issue. But when you don't know what you should do because of the novelty of the circumstances, then you have to start doing ethics. Now the distinction is, as I say, there's an overlapping that I'll even sometimes in ordinary conversation use one or the other just for variety. But there is a difference between that which is an established pattern of behavior that one has received from someone or some culture or some background, church, parents, whatever, and the kind of racking experience that many people have to go through these days when technology has thrust upon us so many perplexing questions. It's one of the ironies of our times that man has to face the most perplexing questions he's ever faced in his history at a time when he is least prepared to answer those questions.
Would what's moral vary from culture to culture?
Oh, yes.
Whereas
yes,
the ethical question might be more universal than that?
Not necessarily, depending upon how you organize your ethics. Now, those of us who are Christians and have Christian presuppositions will find that universal sense conditioning how we do our ethics. On the other hand, if you're talking about a secular society, this may be widely variable from individual to individual. In fact, this is one of the problems in bioethics today. Most of the people who are doing bioethics, and bioethics is kind of a subset ethics in which you're dealing with ethics as they pertain to biological matters such as medicine and genetic engineering and other things where you're dealing with biological matters. But bioethicists these days, because of the secularization of our culture, do in fact share some general principles because they belong to a culture which has had these for centuries, and it's not possible in a single lifetime to completely shuck all the pressures of past conditioning, so that they share the same kind of general culture, but lacking the theological undergirdings for the ethical enterprise. They're often much better at analyzing the questions than they are coming up with answers. And much of the ethical debate these days has to do with dealing with questions of that sort. That is, analyzing the questions rather than attempting to come up with answers. So, a Christian ethicist openly accepts a certain set of presuppositions. And then he does his exploring of these new questions in terms of those principles. That, for example, a Christian ethicist will have a respect for persons, a respect for personhood, will even define personhood in a certain way that gives it a value. Christians value people. It's a part of what Christ taught us in our love for our fellow man. So valuing people is a kind of a basic presupposition, shared by many secular people as well, but at least for the Christian there's a conscious frame of reference within which this takes place. And therefore, one has a somewhat less free-ranging kind of set of answers and a bit more certainty about them that's based upon those presuppositions. I can illustrate that in a couple of problems that are now before the Supreme Court that you know about. These are problems that are widely dividing this nation. The abortion issue is one of those, and the Supreme Court is coping with that issue, Wade versus Roe, piecemeal. And we're going to have a series of decisions by the Supreme Court on the abortion issue, limiting it or freeing it up in one way or another. But they'll tend, I think, because of the divided nature of the country, to sidestep the fundamental issues. And they'll be dealing with ambiguities and uncertainties without coming out with any clear answers, simply because they would have bad law if they did.
And a lot of politics tied into this.
Surely. But you can never form good law if there isn't a kind of a general consensus of the populace for whom the laws are formed. And if you pass a law that half your society doesn't accept, then you've got bad law, because those people are going to reject the law, they're going to violate it, and it simply will become no longer a potent force in their actions and lives. And the Supreme Court is faced with it. A divided nation has asked the Supreme Court to look at issues that are very divisive. And the Supreme Court itself is divided. Reagan was able to get a number of people on the court that reflected his conservative points of view on some of these things, particularly the abortion issue. But they've got them pretty well divided. The decisions are going to be 4 to 5 decisions again and again and again, reflecting the general lack of consensus of the larger society. Abortion is one. And the other one is the prolongation of life. Issues like Nancy Beth Cruzan is raising. When is it permissible, and under what circumstances is it permissible to withdraw life support systems?
Well, now, the public is much more aware of things like this now than when it began teaching ethics.
Oh, yes, that's correct. In fact, bioethics, Mm-hmm. It's a very modern kind of a subset. In fact, I think probably we go back to about the 50s, 1950s, mm-hmm. when you start doing bioethics, because the technology is now explosively expanding. Mm-hmm. And the new problems are coming along. So now a lot of people who are doing ethics, mm-hmm. because they're faced with issues that are not easily resolved and for which we don't have previous patterns. And as I say, the irony is that we've got these problems at a time when our traditional patterns have let us down. They haven't been around long enough for them to become customs yet. And a society that doesn't pay much attention to expressions of certainty from Mount Sinai on mm-hmm. things is much more confused about moral answers.
Do you find it easier to find impressive examples and illustrations now than when you began?
Oh, yes. Yes, the abortion issue has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
Hippocrates prohibited doing abortions. Mm. As father of medicine, he's supposed to have conditioned his pupils over the centuries. And there are still many physicians, including gynecologists and obstetricians, who resist strongly, without any clear reason for doing so, except a kind of respect for life. Mm-hmm. I mean, they like delivering babies. They don't like destroying fetuses. And I know many, many quite secular obstetricians and gynecologists who would be perfectly happy to have laws prohibiting doing abortions, just for the sake of protecting their own interests. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't tell you why, even, perhaps, but it's just kind of a respect for life.
But this has become such an issue since you began. No. You talk about being a Christian ethicist. Yes. Does Islam do ethics?
Oh, yes. In fact, I taught a course in Islamic ethics once.
Was it very different?
It was different and difficult.
I
was in an Islamic kind of country, see, teaching Christians, fortunately. Yeah. And I had a book on Islamic ethics that I read faster than they did, so that helped me through it. But wherever you're talking about moral patterns of behavior, even if you call these taboos, I mean, most primitive people have taboos. It's a part of being human to have these kind of safeguards and guides to behavior that allow you to maintain some kind of living relationship with the other members of your tribe and each other that provides for some kind of social order. Without these rules, social disorder and chaos would be the only result. So that they're necessary. Now, the content is what varies quite widely, although a surprising amount of agreement. There are certain kinds of things, in the sexual realm, for example, that will run from culture to culture to culture, even though they have little contact with each other, because they are human beings, and there are certain patterns of behavior that seem to be necessary to being a human being. Including not killing, for example. At least don't kill members of your own tribe. You may kill the other tribes, but not members of your own tribe. These kinds of taboos are pretty universal, suggesting, first of all, that being a human being is kind of universal. Mm-hmm. And our needs are sort of what St. Thomas Aquinas referred to when he talked about natural law. Some things you know just because it's natural to know them. Mm-hmm. And don't have to have any special revelation to discover it. It's just a part of the laws of nature that you deal with. But that isn't where ethics are being done. The taboos are morals. See, those are passed down to you. When you have you have to ask the question, shall I do this or not? Shall I discontinue a gastrostomy tube that's keeping Nancy Beth Cruzan alive? Shall I withdraw that and let her starve to death? Another one of the things that the presuppositions that come from a Christian context has to do with the definition of human, not only just valuing human, but the definition of it. And at this point, this is probably the most crucial question with which ethicists should deal. Back in the 50s, Joseph Fletcher, who has to be seen as one of the fathers of bioethics, those were the days when technology was just starting to thrust the questions upon us. And he was in on the ground floor, and he wrote a book, a pivotal book, on bioethics entitled Morals and Medicine. And one of the interesting questions that was being raised in that book was whether or not artificial insemination is moral or immoral. Mm-hmm. It was about that time, shortly before that, when I was a medical student, that issue started hitting the news. My first contact with bioethics was at a classroom discussion in which the whole medical class spent two or three days, actually, during their religion class time, discussing whether or not artificial insemination was adultery. And one girl in the class got so upset, she went to the teacher and said to him that if we're going to keep talking on this subject, she wasn't going to attend class anymore. That was before she had become acculturated to medical terms and experience.
Did you solve the question?
We never solved the question. That was my first introduction to a bioethical issue. Well, those, you see, that's a very modern kind of thing. Now we've got all kinds of problems been added to that.
Now, did the idea of sin come into the discussion then?
Whether that was adultery, see, adultery is a sin.
Yeah.
And so while we didn't discuss sin per se, we just assumed that if it was wrong, it was sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to know whether physicians are committing sins when they become involved in such a technique. And now, of course, we've got we've complicated that matter enormously with all the various things we can do in reproductive medicine, with in vitro fertilization and embryo transfers and freezing embryos and all these things that are really quite difficult. But still behind this is the definition of human. To highlight that, let me refer to something as the definition of ethics that one of my teachers in graduate school used, and I think very nicely published in his book. This is by Paul Lehman, who was at Union Theological Seminary and then later at Harvard. He wrote a book, Ethics in a Christian Context. And in this book, he referred to ethics as what God is doing in the world to keep human life human, suggesting there's a certain need that human beings have that requires some kind of structuring of their lives. What God is doing in the world to keep human life human. Well, as soon as you say that, though, you've already raised another question. What do you mean by human? So what is a human being? Well, now, there are various presuppositions that condition our answers to that question, and some of these presuppositions go back a long way. For example, there's the reduction of a human being to a psychic dimension. That is, a human being is a soul. The essential man is not his body. This goes clear back into ancient Greek history and later becomes a part of Christianity through a mingling of Greek and Christian ideas during the early centuries. But Plato once was in one of his Socratic dialogues, describes a conversation with one of Socrates' pupils, Crito. And Socrates is about to die at his own hand. As you remember, he was condemned to drink the hemlock for perverting the youth in Athens, and his disciples were all very worried about this, concerned about the fact that he was going to leave them and so on. They were asking questions, and he gives a whole long picture about what happens to man when he dies. And Crito said, "But how shall we bury you?" And Socrates laughed. He says, "Any way you like, if I don't slip through your fingers." Suggesting there's something about a man that is not a part of his body, that is immortal and goes someplace else, leaving the body behind. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, that you've heard about, is an authority on death and dying. In recent years, has said something like that, almost platonic in her term. She says that it's like a butterfly that leaves its shell as it becomes a butterfly that it doesn't need anymore. Death is not for real. In other words, she says, when we die, we're just casting off a coat that we don't wear, don't need anymore. Winter's over, we cast away an old coat that we don't need anymore, and so we shuck our bodies as we go to the appropriate place for immortal souls. But the essential man there, you see, is not the body. The essential person is something inside of him, what René Descartes would later call the ghost inside the machine.
Well, how can Christians talk about this without it becoming heavily theological?
It does become very theological. In fact, I'm doing theology right now.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about these presuppositions. You see, this notion of this immortal soul, the ghost inside the machine, which is kind of intuitively felt by most of us. When you think of yourself, you know, you use expressions like my hand. Where's the my that owns this hand that moves it around? See, and Descartes is talking about a soul that someplace inside of the being looks out through the windows and listens through the ears and moves these levers around and so on. But inside is the essential self, which again in Platonic terms is immortal and is not necessarily tied to the body. But the notion of an essential self being something separate from the body is one of the presuppositions that goes back a long way and has conditioned Christian thought on the matter for a long time because of St. Augustine and some other people who helped to introduce this notion into Christian thought. Another alternative is what we sometimes call the somatic reduction. That's the psychic reduction. Suke, see, is the soul. That somatic reduction, That is the reduction of a human being to the body. Now, modern science has largely conceived of man in these terms. Man is anatomy, he's physiology, he's neurochemistry. And that makes up the person. It becomes to treat the person as an object that is to be dealt with by objective therapies and so on. So this kind of notion of man is the very basis of scientific medicine. We don't ordinarily treat a soul in medical practice. What we do is give vaccines and antibiotics to a body that is suffering from illness. So you have the somatic reductions, which is kind of the other side of that coin, from the opposite side from the psychic reduction. Well, more recently, there's another presupposition which also has ancient roots, but not as clearly expressed in those ancient roots. In fact, it's the Hebraic biblical notion of man, for which we use the term now holistic.
Spelled how?
Spelled with a W from my standpoint, because I was long, for one of the many years, connected with the university that had as its motto to make man whole. And I felt that spelling that word with an H came out differently. You don't make a man whole in that sense. But it's also partially to counter a current kind of anti-scientific irrationalism that is passing around as holistic, spelt with an H. Mm-hmm. And all kinds of strange things, including some Eastern thought, transcendental meditations, and a whole lot of things that are tied into this, that become a kind of an anti-scientific bag that most physicians feel very uncomfortable with.
You still would use the word holistic, but you'd spell it carefully with a W.
I want to spell it with a W. Well, when I say this, I'm talking about a notion of man that suggests that there is no separable quality about the body and soul that allows them to exist apart from each other. The man has no existence apart from a body, but that he is not reducible to that body. Mm-hmm. And that's the new insight that is now coming, holistic, seen even by persons who rank as neurophysiologists, mm-hmm. are coming to recognize that this complex individual, who's made up of so many different dimensions. Paul Tillich, by the way, used a very nice definition for this when he talked about man as a multidimensional unity. Mm-hmm. He is one in which all the various dimensions, the chemical dimension, the psychic dimension, physical, anatomic, neurochemical, all these things together, center in one whole which makes up the man.
I have an interest. Would he have a dimension, though, that would be comparable to what some call soul and some call spirit? I noticed lately.
No, he wouldn't, I think. Mm-hmm. Not in the classical sense of the word. Mm-hmm. It would rather be an expression of the psyche, our usual contemporary use of the term as in psychology. Mm-hmm. The mind. I think he would want to identify the soul with the mind.
And it's not separable.
Not separable, no. And it even clearly rejects the leveling off of these two qualities, that is the soul and body, as though they're at different levels of reality, perhaps paralleling each other, but they are different levels. And he said, no, you can't do this. And he said, we owe modern psychiatry, psychosomatic medicine, our awareness mm-hmm. that man is a whole being. Well, now if you define man as a whole being, now you're talking about a self that is vulnerable to what happens to the body. For example, anything that happens to the body, any part of it, will affect the whole person one way or another. And we know this to be the case. You can affect your immune mechanisms by stress states mm-hmm. and whatever. So that we know that there is a very definite interrelationship. And this old holistic notion, which, as I say, has biblical grounds, because on a Hebraic grounds alone, man does not lose a soul at death. The soul kind of drains out with the blood, and he's dead and needs a body. And that's why the resurrection doctrine is so important.
I notice Hebrew and Jewish translations of the Bible have dropped the word soul.
Yes.
They're using...
life is one, or person.
Yes, man began to live in Genesis. Yes, man became a living creature or a living being.
That's correct.
This fits in.
But this point of view, Roger Sperry, who won half a Nobel Prize for his work on combinatorial automized brains, mm-hmm. that is a brain where you split it down the middle, you've heard about this, and you've talked about right hemisphere, mm-hmm. left hemisphere reactions and behavior. Well, Roger Sperry at Caltech, he in his address to the committee who gave him the Nobel Prize in Stockholm, described the newer positions that neurophysiologists are taking on this, including stating several times that man is not reduced, man's thought, man's consciousness is not reducible to neurons or to psychochemistry. And he used an interesting kind of expression. He says, the meaning of the message is not in the chemistry of the ink. There's something about a person which he says grants this person then a capacity for freedom, for choice, mm-hmm. and for making rational decisions that is not to be separated from his body, because what happens to the body happens to that, but is neither at the same time reducible to it. So there's more to a person. There's the sum total of this whole person gives him a capacity for functioning, which is selfhood. We're talking here now about the self. Mm-hmm. Now the word self is, I think, what an Old Testament person would be likely to be talking about when he used the term soul, the self of the person. What is a self? We can qualify it in a variety of ways. I'll use a kind of a montage of words here that fit together to indicate what I mean by self. And you'll see in a moment why this is important, because I'm defining human being as a self. By self, we mean the capacity for consciousness. A self is conscious. A self is also self-conscious. That is, he's not only aware, he is aware that he is aware. You and I are talking here, and you're aware that I'm saying some things, but you are also aware that you sitting in that chair being aware that you are aware of what I'm saying. There is the capacity to step outside of oneself enough, to look at oneself objectively enough, gives one a certain control over what takes place. If you're really responding to stimulus, then the stimulus would control you. Any stimulus that came along to which you were conditioned would bring about your response. But if, on the other hand, you have the capacity to look at that, there's an interesting tale that comes down to us from a medieval philosopher by the name of Buridan that came to be known as Asinus Buridani, Buridan's ass. Buridan said that if you take a donkey and put this donkey midway between two equally appealing bales of hay, so the hay is equally stimulating on each side, and they're on opposite sides of the donkey, because the donkey can only respond to stimulus, the stimuli cancel each other out. See, they're in opposite directions. He said the donkey will starve to death. Well, now, he could have gone on and said, but if you put a human being in that same situation and change the bales of hay to something more desirable, such as strawberry ice cream or something, two bowls of ice cream in opposite directions, because you're not stimulus conditioned bound, because you'd be able to be aware of yourself in the circumstances, you as a human being would eat both of them. So you could take charge of the situation because you see it in its larger context. And this is the basis for self-awareness. Not only is one self-aware, one has a capacity as a self to interact with other persons who have the same kind of freedom, and to interact with one's environment, and to do so consciously and rationally and intelligently. These are the things we mean by the self. See, the self is the one who has these capacities. Now, if we say that, then we already have a clue as to how to deal with some of these contemporary problems. Even the abortion problem finally resolves itself down to people differing on when human life begins. That's one thing the Supreme Court is probably not going to handle, when life begins. But that's the key issue. Mm-hmm. See, if it begins in terms of an infusion of an immortal soul at some point in its time, you have to figure out when it is that a fetus gets its soul. You may be left with a conundrum such as that created for us by Aristotle, who, by the way, was followed by the Christian Church for a very long period of time in this, and in fact, cleared it out to the modern period. Aristotle set the pattern for this, and he taught that the soul was infused in the fetus at 40 days for males, mm-hmm. and 80 days for females. Well, now,
a little early chauvinism there.
Yeah, there's a little chauvinism in this, and it already suggests that Aristotle knew what all men know, that it takes longer for a woman to get ready to go someplace than it does for a man.
Exactly.
In any case, it wasn't very helpful, because at 40 days, in those days, you couldn't tell whether it was male or female.
Yeah.
So you'd have to do all your abortions below less than 40 days. Well, that was one way of doing it. But more recent times, it has become the moment of conception. And many people, including Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. think that the moment of conception is the time when humanness is instilled. But in terms of selfhood, does a new embryo, before we even talk about it as a pre-embryo, we've got these now divided down to, when you still have those very primitive cells in the early division stages, those cells can be separate and still survive. I can, for example, take this embryo that first divides into two cells, and then each of those divide, and those keep on dividing. But in those early stages of the division, you could take one of those cells out of that and examine it in the laboratory, tell whether it was a male or female, tell what its genetic history is by examining chromosomes and so on, without affecting the cluster that was left behind. In fact, you could separate this. It's been done with animals. I don't think anybody's tried it yet with human beings yet for ethical reasons. But you could separate those cells in an early period, and each one of those would mature. You could create twins. That raises interesting questions about the doctrine of the soul. You mean human being with a scalpel, a very fine scalpel, that is, that could cut these cells apart, could actually create two souls.
Two souls.
Or maybe more than that, which is the thing that happens in identical twins. You see, the cells divide, and they separate, and so you end up with two complete human beings. But during that early stage, they call this pre-embryonic. Well, does that pre-embryo, that is just a collection of protoplasmic cells, is it a self? See, when does it become a self? If we define self as I've defined it, it isn't conscious, obviously. Although you can start picking up electrochemical activity with electroencephalograph, for example, quite early in the development of a fetus, being a self in terms of being aware, and in that awareness, by the way, is also a kind of a moral sense that makes up the self, capacity for being responsible, for choosing. Christians sometimes speak about the image of God as the power to think and to do and not merely reflect other men's thoughts. You see, the capacity for self-determination, for choice. And certainly this pre-embryo doesn't have it. Well, when does it get it? That's a very difficult kind of question to answer, because there's no time when that definition can apply. And we have to find other reasons for looking at the abortion issue than finding out when the self begins. And to the ending of life, part of our problem with Nancy Beth Cruzan is that we don't know whether she has any self left. See, when the self dies at the end of life, it loses all those capacities, and it's possible even to give a definition of death. Now, we talk about cellular death, and talk about organ system death, the cessation of your cardiopulmonary system, and so on, the vital signs disappearing. We can talk about brain death. We define brain death now with a set of criteria that makes it pretty precise. But it might be that what we're pointing to in each one of these, because each one of those is a somatic reduction definition. If a person is dead when his brain has ceased to function, you say, this thing called the brain has died, then the patient is dead. You've reduced him to a thing. On the other hand, you see, if you had a psychic reduction, you could destroy the brain, you just haven't touched the soul that slips through your fingers in Socrates' words. But in this holistic sense, one surely will have a self dead when the brain is dead. That's always the case. But you could also have it the other way around. You could have a live brain and a dead self. And increasingly, there are people who are beginning to suggest that we perhaps need another definition of death. That is the death of the self. When the self has been irrevocably lost, so there's no more consciousness possible, and we have what the physicians call persistent vegetative state, which can last for a very long time before the organ system collapses. But they're suggesting what we need is a way of saying, even though this person is still breathing, heart still beating, doesn't require a lot of assistance for this, has a brain stem still functioning, but is in a coma, a deep, profound coma. This has been going on for years. We can decide that that doesn't make sense. It's not even humane to keep this organism going by artificial aids such as forced feeding, because that's what gastrostomy tubes are about. You're forcing that person to eat. They can't eat anymore otherwise, and so you're forcing food upon them. But there comes a time when one could say, this person is dead, there's no sense in doing this. And that might preclude what happened some years ago to Karen Quinlan, who lived for 9 years, when she finally died, was just a little bag of bones, weighed about 65 pounds. But the whole 9 years, never once showed any sign of intelligence, any sign of selfhood, and then finally died spontaneously. But they kept her going all those 9 years with a gastrostomy tube.
But now when these folk are out picketing outside an abortion clinic, they have a variety of views. Maybe they'd all call themselves Christians.
In fact, they have a variety of reasons for being there, too,
yes,
including having fun, doing something interesting and less boring, and whatever, all kinds of reasons why people take up causes. But for the most part, the right to lifers mm-hmm. are basing their attitudes on the notion that this, at the moment of conception, this mm-hmm. becomes a full human being because it has a human soul. And if you destroy a human soul or separate that human soul from its body, which would be what death in those terms would be about, what you've done is to commit murder. And since this is a fully human soul, regardless of its function or how much it's learned or how wise or intelligent it is, in this case not intelligent or wise or learned, but regardless of that, it's just as human as his mother. And if you destroy a human being, even if it's just a new conceptus, then you've committed murder.
Are they thinking of a baby soul, a baby spirit?
No.
Those who see immortal spirits who've existed before, now being infused, as it were, into the embryo, that's not a new spirit. That's one that's existed before. There are many theological views that impinge on this.
Yes, right? You know,
you're destroying something that has existed for some time before.
To some, a major point of view is that a soul is created at the moment it's infused.
Mm-hmm.
See, but there's the Plato taught that the eternal existence of souls,
yeah.
as the Mormons do, as a matter
yes.
of fact, pre-existing souls yeah. that are put in body at a certain point in time. But the major position is one in which the soul is created at the time it's...
So one's theological convictions, which may mean a great deal to a person, certainly are influencing his ethical understandings.
All kinds of ethical understandings in this. And why I'm saying this holistic notion is being so attractive is because it enables us now. Mm-hmm. One woman in a persistent vegetative state, by persistent vegetative means their organ systems are functioning, mind is gone, no awareness, nothing going on in the mind. The mind has simply ceased to function. And that's irrevocable because the brain tissue has been damaged. Mm-hmm. Such an individual continuing to live in that persistent vegetative state. There's on record the case of a woman who lived for 37 years and 111 days, mm-hmm. never once acknowledging any kind of interhuman reactions, never once letting anybody know that she was aware of what was going on, just completely out of it. For 37 years, 111 days. And it costs something like $100,000 to $150,000 a year to look after a persistent vegetative state. Well, we shouldn't reduce the human dimension here to material concerns like money. Facts of the case are we don't have enough to go around now for all the medical care needs. And if we are meaninglessly squandering funds, keeping a complex tissue organism alive that should long ago have been buried, see, we ought to know that, make up that decision so that we don't waste our funds that way. But your definition of the self, you see, is one way of getting at this. One could have said that Karen Quinlan died as a self shortly after she got into trouble. And therefore, what they were doing was just simply keeping a tissue specimen alive for all those 9 years. One of the problems of this definition of death has to do with the fact that it is difficult to make. You can't always be sure. I remember as a medical intern learning very quickly that one had to be careful about what one said in the presence of people in deep comas. There was a patient we had that I was caring for who had been in a profound coma and didn't respond to anything. And I was discussing her case with the chief who had come on his rounds. And we were talking medical language instead of using our best bedside manner because she didn't know what was going on, of course. The next day she came out of her coma and told us everything we said. See, so that I learned very quickly that you can't always be sure. How do you know whether a person is aware? There is a condition, for example, that you probably know about, schizophrenia know about, but there's a catatonic schizophrenia, which an individual may assume a completely immobile stance, just no sign of any movement in life or any awareness. And you try to talk to them, try to get them to signal that somehow they hear you. Mm-hmm. They just completely ignore you. You begin to assume, they can't hear you or something. Mm-hmm. And such persons may recover to a certain extent and, report the whole thing. If they're aware of it, they just couldn't respond in a conscious, open way. Well, how do you know when a person is comatose? Nancy Beth Cruzan. For example, when you walk in the room, her eyes will follow you. You know, that's kind of scary. Deciding somebody who can look around the room a bit, blink their eyes, and the face looks warm and alive. The death experience, is a pretty remarkable thing with somatic death. When the body quits breathing and circulation stops, all of us physicians have experienced seeing people die one time or another. unless we have some kind of specialty that takes us off into a laboratory someplace. Mm-hmm. But it's a striking experience. Almost like they pull down the curtains, the eyes glaze over. The whole thing just kind of stops. You know, immediately this person has died. It's but how can you say somebody's dead who's blinking her eyes? Eh? That's part of the problem, because the family and the physicians have decided that she's dead as far as person is concerned. And that this doesn't make any sense to keep supporting her with all these artificial aids when she's dead. The courts disagreed on that, so now the Supreme Court has to decide, is Nancy Cruzan, is it permissible to discontinue her life support system? And the trouble is, I saw her on TV, and I, as a physician, as I looked at her, I'd have some second thoughts about whether that person's alive or not, you see? I recognized that she couldn't respond, but how do you go about finding that out? You say, look, you know, are you in there? If you hear me, blink your eyes, or move your finger or something. If she just accidentally blinked her eyes at the appropriate moment, that could be kind of confusing, wouldn't it? See? So it's kind of hard to know. So people who are even advocating self-death are now suggesting we may have to use markers that are actually based on our understanding of the body as an object. That is, the somatic reduction. Maybe brain death is the best we can do, because you can't be sure about this other. But there must be some cases in which you can be sure, and perhaps we can develop some better tests. But eventually, that presupposition that human being is a whole being, including mind and body and interaction, you see, there must be some tests we can develop that will help us to know when that has ceased. And so we can talk about some remaining organic things happening, but the person is dead. And now to be treated the way we treat a corpse, behavior that is appropriate in relationship to a corpse. And to make that decision is the tough one. But you see, the presuppositions make a great deal of difference. If you have the psychic reduction, then when the person dies, mm-hmm. you want evidence that has departed. I asked a Catholic mm-hmm. priest recently, mm-hmm. How long after the person seems to have died would you still go through the last rites? Mm-hmm. Well, his response was, I don't know whether this is a general teaching of the church or not, his response was that it is believed that the soul hovers around the body for maybe 2 or 3 hours. So it's permissible for us to use the last rites on them. And of course, as you know, with what's happening with these near-death experiences, you're getting all kinds of people who are now saying that's evidence of that mm-hmm. there is such a thing as departing. We use that language, the departed. Mm-hmm. See? Mother passed away. She went someplace. That's all psychic reduction language. Somatic reduction language, mm-hmm. blood pressure has disappeared. The heartbeat and vital signs have gone, and he's dead. The self-definition mm-hmm. wants to know, is anybody in there? Do you hear me? See? Can you respond?
Now, the psychic reduction, you call it. The theological considerations and presuppositions that would make people resistant to abortion, are they consistent at the other end and say, well, if the person dies, his immortal soul goes to eternal bliss, why should we keep this poor soul here year after year when we could release it and let it go? Are they consistent?
They're not. I think they're not consistent. Now, they would argue that, of course, and I talked yes. to a man just this last week in a conference in Portland in which he talked about the sin of separating the soul from the body. If you separate the soul from the body, that's wrong for you to do that.
He's trying to be consistent then, isn't he, throughout? See,
but it struck me as a little strange. In fact, even at the beginning of life, why should you worry about fetuses if they have an immortal soul? You're just touching the body anyway, and a little glob of protoplasm, more or less. The rest of it survives anyway, so why worry about it?
The soul gets there sooner.
That's right. And certainly at the ending of life, it would seem to be a logical kind of discussion. I preached a funeral sermon for one of my former students' child who was killed in an automobile accident some years ago. And the man's wife belonged to a religious tradition which took strongly the immortal soul notion, the psychic reduction. And of course, I hold the holistic notion. And so I talked about the necessity of the resurrection as a way for survival in the hereafter. Mm-hmm. I spent a good deal of time giving the hope of the resurrection. Mm-hmm. And the wife asked another preacher to come along and preach a sermon too. So we had two sermons. And he, with his other psychic reduction persuasion, talked about little Johnny being in heaven looking down at us. Mm-hmm. Johnny's with Jesus, and he's happy now, so you don't have to worry. Mm-hmm. The two sermons were in sharpest contrast. We didn't have any arguments at the point. We just simply presented our sermons, and that was it.
Covered both the bases.
But the inconsistency of it has not been lost on some very important theologians.
Are the same folk opposed to capital punishment then?
Probably.
There is consistency there?
I would think so, yes. It kind of becomes kind of a respect for life that, I also share. But I, when I'm talking about respect for life, there are certain qualities of life that take priority over others. Mm-hmm. And I would say life in general, while valuable, because it is, from my standpoint, a gift of the Creator, and is therefore something to be respected. If it's in competition with higher life, I sacrifice the lower in favor of the higher. Mm-hmm. And this is my basis for saying abortions may have to be done in some cases. Mm-hmm. Pretty rare now because of our medical technology, but there are still cases in which a woman's life is on the line if she gets pregnant. Mm-hmm. And sacrifice of that fetus in order to save the life of the mother. You see, is the difference between just life that is perhaps potential in terms of what it can become one day is in competition with somebody who is already actual. I'll give a higher level to the one, even while I respect the life of a fetus. Mm-hmm. See, all of life is valuable, but some lives are more valuable than others.
But in the psychic reduction view, if you take the life of the fetus, and there is a soul there, it's going to immortal bliss.
Or, unless you've baptized it to limbo.
Yes.
Which is another kind of problem. But if that's the case, you should think that it shouldn't bother you as much.
Not so much.
Yes. So I suspect that this is not well thought through by many of the people who are advocating mm-hmm. pro-life. Mm-hmm. And I can sympathize with their feelings and share them, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. I'm very impressed with Schweitzer's reverence for life notion. Mm-hmm. It's a part of my respect for God to have a feeling of reverence for that which he's created, and life being the highest level of his creation.
So there can be some common ground.
Oh yes, there's common ground. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably that common ground would become more apparent mm-hmm. if we could only get around the other hidden agendas that are behind some of these movements. Mm-hmm. There are hidden agendas there that do not permit rational decision making to occur.
Would that even influence a Supreme Court justice?
I'm afraid it might. I hope these Supreme Court justices are objective enough to recognize that. Mm-hmm. But, people who become dedicated to causes often do so because of the emptiness of their lives. Mm-hmm. That's the hidden agenda. You'll find inconsistencies. People who are violently opposed to war. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nonsense, mm-hmm. contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right in the very words you use.
And this is what ethics does. It tries to analyze what are the basis for our judgments about right and wrong. What are the presuppositions? And if we can discover a common sharing of the presuppositions, discovering then the logical implications of those presuppositions may very well help to eradicate the tensions that divide us.
Will there always be a measure of compromise?
Well, I suppose probably compromise about the presuppositions, since sometimes those are more difficult. Theologians have been wrestling about presuppositions for a long time.
Yes. So to understand those three viewpoints
is what ethics does. Now, see, there are three definitions of human. Mm-hmm. If we say, as my professor did, that what God is doing in the world to keep human life human is what ethics is about, mm-hmm. then we define human. There are three possible ways of doing this. One of these, largely dependent upon ancient Greek sources, and kind of universal primitive sources as well, mm-hmm. notions of spirits that depart are not totally the province of Platonic Greece. Mm-hmm. Plato got the credit because he wrote it down nicely, you see. Then the other, a somatic reduction in which we lose any sense of spiritual realities, where all that matters, or all that is subject to human experiment, objective analysis, as in science. And then finally, a biblical notion which is now having a new expression since we've come to understand the interaction of mind and body mm-hmm. as a holistic notion. So psychic reduction, somatic reduction, and a holistic understanding. Now I'm suggesting that this new holistic understanding becomes the basis mm-hmm. for a way of looking at some of these complex problems, including deciding when it's time to quit. See, if you can decide that a person certainly has lost his capacity to be a self. The person is self-dead. It is permissible then to treat with respect, but also in the ways that that corpses are appropriately treated, and not to continue something which really reflects our ignorance rather than an adequate rational decision.
Is that being accepted more widely now?
Well, it's on the way.
On the way.
And I think the next definition of death will go somewhat in that direction, so we'll end up legally. Because right now we're stuck with a legal definition. The closest you can approach that self-notion is the brain death. Mm-hmm. But we've so defined this objectively that it is a somatic reduction. Mm-hmm. And I say that we have to go further, or else we're going to still be dealing with the Nancy Beth Cruzans and the Karen Quinlans and the others, and the lady with 37 years and 111 days in a coma, irrationally, because there's no way to solve the problem because we haven't defined it precisely. If we get a little farther down that slope, protecting the slope so we don't slide too far, but down far enough down the slope to say there's another definition of death. In fact, this is what death has always really meant. Mm-hmm. It's not just the loss of a thing, even the loss of a brain, but the loss of a self. When self-death has occurred, then it's really happened. And all the other deaths were pointing to that, were indicators of it, markers of it. And I'm saying rationality should enable us to formalize that and put it into law so that with appropriate safeguards we could give up the nonsense that is represented by the Nancy Beth Cruzan case.
When all those distinguished justices are sitting there talking this through, how much of what you've said the last few minutes might influence their thinking?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
How are they going to make the decision?
I always have the impression that people who get to the Supreme Court probably are reasonably well-educated and have thought things through for many years. And my guess is that they wouldn't find this too difficult to cope with, but I have no way of knowing.
How many might take a holistic view?
I don't know either, without finding out by asking them.
Has this changed a great deal since you began teaching ethics?
Oh, yes. Changed in me since I began teaching ethics.
You explain this differently from when you began.
Oh, yes. The ethical enterprise is an ongoing enterprise.
It isn't just the illustrations you use.
That's the difference between ethics and morals, as I told you at the outset. Mm-hmm. My moral certainties remain pretty secure, you see. Things that I was taught were wrong generally are wrong, mm-hmm. and I still hold them to be wrong. So my moral attitudes remain the same. Mm-hmm. But I've had to examine some attitudes where there are uncertainties, but one has to try to apply those principles to specific cases. Mm-hmm. And that calls for kind of an ongoing growth. So I suspect that if you were to be able to pick up a tape back in the days when tapes were not being made, mm-hmm. you would have found me saying some things that I've since wanted to develop into a much deeper and broader perspective.
You said something along the way that I tucked in the back of my computer in case I had a chance to ask you. You talked about God doing ethics. What did you mean by God doing ethics?
I didn't say God was doing ethics. That ethics has to do with God's work in the world at keeping human life human.
Okay, ethics has to do with what God is doing in the world.
But it's a good question, because it also raises another issue in my own ethical understanding. And that is that ethics has to do with certainties. I mean, there are certain basic principles of right and wrong in the world. Mm-hmm. This is not something that is made up de novo with each individual and each new cultural situation. Mm-hmm. That in fact, ethics may express not only what God is doing, but what God did mm-hmm. when he created. In other words, for example, right and wrong may be patterns of behavior that we have discovered either by revelation or by investigation or experience, patterns of behavior that protect and preserve those qualities of life that you desire and that are meaningful to you. For example, it's possible to say, just on the basis of observation, I think, that man is generally a social animal. There are exceptional people who like to be alone, but there are most people who like to be together. It seems to be almost a fact of humanness that we cluster. And it seems to be a part of what brings happiness and self-fulfillment that we do this. Well, now, to have people who have meaningful clusters there are certain basic premises that are there as the basis for those clusters. Mm-hmm. Trust is one of them. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to believe people before you can have a community. And if God made us for a community, and there's a nice biblical text that said man was not made to be alone, mm-hmm. if we were made for community, the basis for community is trust. You can't have a community if people don't tell the truth to each other. It's a basic kind of rule. Mm-hmm. So in a revelation of ethical patterns, very basic principles, such as the Ten Commandments, for example, mm-hmm. I'm suggesting that God gave us some guidance to how to be true to our creation. He wanted us to enjoy a community, so therefore he said, thou shalt not bear false witness. Mm-hmm. The rules are there as ways of preserving and protecting that quality which was in the intention of God at the time of creation. Man is a created being mm-hmm. who has certain qualities about him that are aspect of his humanness. And God said, all right, now here's how you keep this, how you preserve this quality. Mm-hmm. And we are left with the privilege of taking some of those basic principles and carrying this step further. And maybe at another occasion we'll talk about things such as artificial kinds of family structures. Surrogate parenting, for example. What's wrong with surrogate parenting? Even the Bible has examples of surrogate mm-hmm. parenting. What's wrong with surrogate parenting? We could say that any kind of human behavior that places in jeopardy the basic patterns of community, family, for mm-hmm. example, anything you do that weakens the meaning of family and thus the possibility of family, strikes against the Creator's intention. And so one can theologically find the basis, if you press far enough, for looking at a variety of things that threaten, including, if you please, and we want to talk about this maybe a little, such things as homosexual behavior, mm-hmm. particularly advocacy of this as an alternative kind of lifestyle, places the meaning of family in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. Anytime you start jeopardizing the Creator's intention, then you see you're striking against the very substance of moral existence.
Mm-hmm. You've so often referred to the Bible. You've spoken theologically, you've talked about God, you've talked about the Creator. You're a Christian ethicist. When you sit down with the man who might be regarded as a secular ethicist, can you communicate with him? You've served on one of the American colleges, and you've helped make ethical decisions for that group.
Yes.
What happens when you sit together?
For about 10 years, I was a consultant to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Yeah. And ethics, the bioethics committee.
You got very involved in some important decisions.
And
then
this committee was made up of a cross-section of the country.
Yeah.
There was an atheist or two on the group. Mm-hmm. There was a Roman Catholic. There was a Jew, a Seventh-day Adventist. Very interesting mix of peoples. Mm-hmm. And what we discovered to our amazement was how much we shared.
Oh, this is important.
Yeah. We all share some underpinnings that are part of our general Judaic-Christian culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't pay your debts anymore, you still owe it.
Can you name those basic ones?
Those basic things are respect for human life, yeah. for one thing. See, mm-hmm. respect for basic things like honesty and so on. The mm-hmm. things that we know mm-hmm. make community tick. And we feel badly when we defraud somebody or when we tell lies. And this is just a part of what we all feel.
But you couldn't agree on a holistic approach.
Well, that took a bit more talking.
Were you moving toward it?
Oh, yes, because that group, of course, was a fairly sophisticated group of people, highly educated, most of them, heads of departments in various universities and so on. They're pretty sophisticated sort of people, and so that we were moving that direction. And in fact, we did get a chance to talk about it on several occasions. But the notion of abortion, what surprised me was to discover how many of those leading OBGYN professors and deans, whatever, across the country, did not like the idea of physicians performing abortions. And one of their major decisions was trying to figure out how to develop alternatives to abortion. That is, so people wouldn't have to have abortions. They were looking at things like finding ways of picking up the tabs so a young mother who became pregnant through whatever reason didn't have to give up her career in college or in school. Find ways of supporting her so that she wouldn't have to have an abortion in order to satisfy her career needs. And all kinds of things like this were in the hopper. And it was a very interesting discussion. But we did discover we shared a lot more than we thought we would. And I think that's generally the case. So that in my contact with the mixed audiences, many of whom are quite secular people, I'm really quite surprised at how often I get a good response. fact, I was once asked to give a lecture on abortion to a convention that was held down in North Carolina, University of North Carolina, in which they had a convention to which probably 600 or 800 OBGYN people came to discuss second trimester abortion. Now, second trimester, yeah. You're getting along pretty mature by that time. I stayed in a motel and with some of the other people, and was taken to the convention center in the back of a van with several other people who were attending, and these were practically all OBGYN people. And there was one fellow there who was apparently running an abortion mill, and he said that he had done 2,300 abortions in the time since Wade versus Roe had come through it. Mm-hmm. 2,300 abortions. And he was laughing about it as he said this. I thought, here I am, I'm going to talk about abortion to this audience. Mm-hmm. And so I was the last one on the program. So I said, well, this is what I'll do. I'll get up and say it like I think it. And then the door wasn't too far away, so I figured I could get out of there if I could drop my bombshell. And so I did. I talked very much about respect for life and so on, and just decided that there was no point in pulling any punches. And after I was finished, I was astonished. They clapped and clapped and clapped, almost a standing ovation from these people. And afterwards, people came up, you know, and this is what they wanted to hear. Here were all these obstetricians who felt badly about the way things were going, who didn't like the idea that 1.5 million babies were aborted last year. See, this was alien to their better instincts. They knew it had to be done sometimes, but the fellow who had done 2,300, he was an exception. He was very quiet.
Do you think the general public has that impression of the
I don't know. General obstetrician? I just don't know. I think that the ones who are concerned, who are carrying the placards, don't really want it to be that way. Yeah. They'd like to be able to placard, feel like they're out there fighting the dragons.
Tell us, what would be the next step the next time we talk together? What will you take up next?
Well, I'd like to say a little bit more about human and other ways in which that humanness can be threatened. I'm concerned about some mind-manipulating things, for example, that may very well have ethical implications if we define a human being as a self, and a self as a self-determinant, choosing, responsible being.
So that's a direct continuation of what you've been presenting.
Yes, this just sort of starts it.
Oh, good.
May go back on some of this, too, so save some questions if you have
them. Oh, good. Thanks, Jack. Okay.